Ilo Ovoein, and he was the Ilmein, he was the guardian, he was the nurse of Hadassah, who was Esther, the daughter of his beloved uncle, because she had no father nor mother, and the maiden was beautiful of form and goodly in appearance. And with the death of her father and her mother, or on account of the death of her father and her mother, Lekocho Mordechai Lelevas, literally, Mordechai took her unto him as a daughter. And I explained to you that the word daughter is explained in the Gemara not as vas, but as bayit, as home, as house. And this means that he took her to be his wife. And now we've got the position where Esther is the wife of Mordechai. Now when it says the wife of Mordechai, I think I have had occasion to explain to you that according to Jewish law, there are two distinct parts to a marriage. The first part is called the betrothal, and the second part is called a marriage. And today there is no distinction between the betrothal and the marriage, but the one follows immediately after the other. Both, of course, still exist. And what we have today is the betrothal taking place, where the bridegroom gives his bride a ring and says to her in the presence of two witnesses, "You are betrothed to me with the ring according to the law of Moses and of Israel." And then begins the second part of the marriage ceremony, which consists of standing beneath the chuppah. Now, once upon a time, for very good reasons, the bridegroom took his bride away. His bridegroom went to his own home, and the bride to her own home immediately after the betrothal. Not ever to be confused with an engagement. Engagement is tannoim, and that is something else. And for a whole year, they would live each in their respective homes. At the end of the year, then the marriage ceremony would take place, which comprised standing beneath the chuppah representing the home, and showing the seriousness of intention on the part of the bridegroom to take his bride into his home, and by her standing with him under the chuppah, the bride's seriousness of intention of accompanying her bridegroom to his home. And then that was the conclusion of the marriage ceremony, and then they went back. But it was in this intermediate period, which consisted of at least a year. It could have been more than a year. It could have been considerably more than a year. And when it says that she was amongst the maidens which were taken, she was in this intermediate period. But she, being a betrothed, means that one is a full wife to the bridegroom, to the husband, but there wasn't the living together, the physical living together that didn't exist. So there was a companionship, but there wasn't the physical living together. And when the word of the king got round and his commandments that all the maidens were to be gathered to Shushan the capital, we are told in verse 8, Batilo kach Esther beis hamelach, Esther was taken to the palace, Eyad Hegai Shomeranoshu, into it was put under the charge of Hegai, who was the custodian of the women. And that is the beginning of the story, yes.
Well, Esther was living with Mordechai originally, after his parents died. So once she was betrothed to him, did he have to...
She went into her own apartment.
Okay, so she went out for the year, and then she
was... could have been 5 years. Okay. She was living in her own apartment, so to say, but they were together during the daytime. She stayed into the house, and all that during the daytime. Now, what we are going to discuss, and we started discussing a little bit already, was what relationship existed and was there to exist between Mordechai and Esther on the one hand, and what kind of relationship was there to exist between the Achashverosh, the king, and Esther on the other hand. What relationship was there to be, and what relationship could there be between Achashverosh and Esther? That is something that we've got to resolve. In order to understand that, bearing in mind that we are dealing with a book of the Tanakh, and a book of the Tanakh means that it is godly. And please don't use that word divinely inspired. Everyone is divinely inspired. And one can do things which are not divinely inspired and which are demonic. And where are you going to say what is divinely inspired and what is not divinely inspired? What are you going to put it down to? We don't believe in divinely inspired as being the reason for a book being included in the Tanakh. Divinely inspired is not the expression. The expression is there is direct communication between God and the individual concerned. Direct communication. How exactly that communication goes, that's a different matter. That is something that I've touched on from time to time, and it's something that I will have reason to deal with considerably in considerably greater detail than I have until now. Now, in order to understand this relationship, we've got to go down to something that is completely fundamental, and something that I have never really dealt with in this year. What I have done is from time to time I've touched upon various aspects of it. When I've spoken to you about reality, and I've explained to you what is reality, and how man can relate to reality, it was then that I began on this subject. But now I'm taking it much more deeply than I've ever taken it before. And in order to understand what man is and his relationship to this reality, we have got to consider the two descriptions of man that is given in the Torah. These are descriptions of man which have been distorted to such an extent that they have become completely secular. And they become secular to such an extent that they are actually atheistic. We've got two separate descriptions of man that is given in the Torah. The first one is given, Bereishis 1, verse 27. And it starts as follows. And God created man in his image, in the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them and said unto them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the heaven, and over every creature that moves upon the earth. And that is the first description of man. Of the creation of man. In this 1 verses 27, 28 in Greek. Greek means Genesis. In the beginning. The first book of the Bible. Right. The second account of the creation is completely different. It says, and the Lord God formed the man dust out of the earth, and he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. Then it goes on, and it says, and the Lord God took the man, in verse 15, and placed him in the Garden of Eden, to guard it, to till it, to work it, and to guard it. Doesn't say anything of that in the first account. And he says, then it goes on and he tells us, says, and God, the Lord God, said, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make for him a helpmate and a companion. And then the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and he closed the flesh instead of it, and the Lord God built the rib that he had taken from the man into a woman, and he brought her to man. That is the second account. Now we find essentially four differences between the first account and the second account, and we have already touched on these four differences when we discussed the subject last week. In the first account, man is created in the image of God. In the second account, God breathes into his nostrils the soul of a life, literally. Nishmas Chaim is better, the breath of life, it's better to translate it, breathe into his nostrils, in the shock. First one is created in the image of God. In the second one, God breathes into him a Nishmas Chaim, which of course immediately suggests that there is something of God in the man himself. The second difference is that when, in the first account of man, he is commanded, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the heaven, and over every creature that moves upon it. In the second, there is no mention of power, there is no mention of dominion. There is only mention to kill it and to guard it. That is all that is required of man. He is called upon to kill it and to guard it. Now comes a major difference. Subdue to Lichbosh. Now comes a major difference, and this is the third difference. In the first description of man, it says he created them male and female, exactly the same as all the other animals. All the animals were also created male and female. There's no mention of male being created first and then female. There's no creation of animals being created only one of a kind, a male and a female. It's possible that several animals were created together. God created man, and female. That is how he created them. That is in the first creation, in the first account. In the second account, it's completely different. In the second account, man is created alone. It is only afterwards that God says it's not good for man to be alone, and I will find for him a helpmate and a companion. Now that is, of course, a very major difference. And lastly, an important difference is, whereas in the first account of the creation of man, the word Elohim is used, God and Almighty, and in the second account, the name Hashem is used. And that also makes for certain differences. Now those are the two accounts that are given to us in the Torah of the creation of man. Two completely different accounts. And obviously there is something that is being communicated to us in these two different accounts of man. You must bear in mind, when we are speaking about the first man that is created, and is created in the image of God, it speaks there about man generally. This is the human race. That is what it's speaking about there. And now we have to analyze both these accounts of marriage. I want to deal at the outset with the two differences. The one that in the first account is described as being created in the image of God, whereas in the second account that isn't mentioned at all. God breathes into his nostrils the breath of life. In the first account, he is commanded, fill the heaven, fill the earth, conquer it, subdue it, have dominion over it, rule over it. That is what he said in the first one. In the second one, kill it, till the earth, and guard it. You are a custodian over it. And I want to examine with you this evening what are actually the differences. Now, when we say that God is created in the image, man is created in the image of God, that means that man has the most striking resemblance to Hashem. The most striking resemblance to Hashem is, and that is the image of God in which he's been created, is that man's drive for creativity. That man, as God is a creator, man is striving to become a creator. He is endowed with a drive for creative ability, and he has all the resources for the realization of this goal. The resources are his intelligence, his intellect, his brain. Those are his resources, and it's with these resources that he is able to go forward and to be the initio of his creator. When man comes into the world, endowed with all his faculties, and he views the universe, he immediately asks a question, he must ask the question. And his question is, how does all this function? That is this man that is created in the image of God. The man whose destiny it is to subdue the universe and to put it all at his own disposal. The question that he asks is, how does the cosmos function? How does it work? And when he asks that question, he doesn't ask it per se, how does it work? He wants to know what the workings of it is. He asks it for a practical reason. He wants to know how it works because he wants to know what to do with it all. How is he going to use it? He wants to know how it works for a very practical reason. He wants to know how it works for its practical implications. And that is all that he's interested in at this particular moment. I want to give you a comparison to that. In the previous decade, in fact even before that, in the 1960s there was a new cry that went up. What is the relevance? If it isn't relevant, I'm not interested. Not only that, everything one studies must have relevancy. In other words, it must be utilitarian. If I'm going to study something, I must be able to translate it into use, into work. That is a view of life. There is nothing wrong in that view of life. What is wrong in that view of life, if it is a view of life to the exclusion of everything else, then there's something wrong with it. What is wrong in that life is that if it is viewed completely divorced from anything spiritual, then there is something wrong. If it is a form of life which has no meaning, no purpose, then it is wrong. But there is nothing wrong in taking all that the universe possesses, harnessing it and using it for our own purposes. Now, This is one aspect of man, and that is the man as he appears in the first account. That is an ability that is given him, and that is how he emerges. I don't want you to think that two separate people were created. The second account is an elaboration of the first account, and the two complement one another. And these are two different aspects of the one and only man. I am not the same man when I am eating my food and having my bath and polishing my shoes as I am when I'm saying my prayers and when I'm giving a shiur and when I'm studying the Torah. But I am the same. I'm performing two completely different functions, but I am one and the same man. And here you've got the two accounts of man, and in the first account you are given a picture of man, but this picture of man is only one part of man. And this is the ability that he's given him, and this is what he does with it. And he's there to take this universe and to harness it and to dominate over the forces of nature. Everything about it is utilitarian. His motivation, as far as the origin of the world is concerned, as far as the origin of the cosmos is concerned, all he is interested in is how can he use it. He asks how, but he doesn't ask why is this all. He doesn't ask what is it all about. That he doesn't ask. This is one aspect of the human being. His method is utilitarian, and his purpose is utilitarian. It's only practical, and he wants it for his own use. That is the man in the first account. What do you want to ask, Joseph? Now, cosmos is the universe. Call it the universe. If you don't like the word, call it the world. Everything in the world, the stars, the moon, the sun, planets, the galaxies, that's it, the earth, that is the universe. The powers that there are in the universe. Terrific powers. No, please, that's mysticism. Please, just leave it all alone. Leave that severely alone. You'll never get anywhere with that. You'll always be up in the air and you'll never be down on earth. And have I told you how dangerous it is to start flying from the top of the Empire State Building? What's the power of it? What's the power of it? Have you ever seen animals there? Have you up there? You see these structures. How do you know it? Animals up there. Please just leave the mysticism out. You don't have to do anything. Just leave it alone. Don't touch that. You'll be so confused. And you'll never be down to the real things to the earth. That one does when one's done the whole of Shas. Pshat is, if you do 2 pages a day, and you do 2 pages a day, you've got to spend at least 48 hours a day on it. You might manage it in 7 years. That is, the whole of Aloha, you know, the whole of Pshat. That's mysticism. It's not even Kabbalah. We are nowhere real ready for that. We are down on speaking about the man, the type of man that you see all over. You go to Calcutta. Is that how it's pronounced?
Calcutta.
You go there. You see them there. You see them all over. You go to Berkeley. You see them there. That is, wherever you go, you see these people. You see them round about you. You see them in the streets. Those are the people that we've got to understand before we go any further. You follow, Rosalind? We're just plain, we are down to earth. This is the type of man that is described in the first account. He's the type of man whom we see. He's all round about us. He's just interested in the practicalities of life. How he can harness it all. How it can become part of him. That is all that he's interested in. It goes a little bit beyond that. Now, he wants to know how it all functions. And then he says, now, what does he set out to achieve? When he knows how it functions. For what purpose does he want to know how it functions? What is it that he wants to achieve? Now here there is a very beautiful and interesting chapter in the Book of Psalms. I'm afraid of it. The Psalm says as follows. Speak about man. Thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. The fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, sheep and oxen, all of them, yea, and the beasts of the field, whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas, everything has been put at man's feet. Thou, O Lord, hast made him to have dominion over all the work of thy hands. One aspect of man, a purpose of man. And that is how the psalmist describes. But the interesting thing is, it says thou hast made him but little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Now that word honor in Hebrew is kovod, and that is a very important word. It's difficult to translate that word into English, and probably the best translation of all would be not honor, but it would be different. And we've got to try and understand what is this difference. Now the question that we've got to discuss is, what is this thing? It is something that gives the human being glory, and it is something that gives him a majesty. Now an animal isn't dignified. An animal is completely helpless. He can help himself only to save his life, but he cannot harness his environment. Human existence is completely different. Human existence is powerful. The human being can be master over his environment, and he's not subject to his environment. The animal can't think, he's helpless, he's instinctive. A human being is intelligent, he can plan, and he's resourceful. Quite a different thing. Now, if I were asked to explain to you what dignity is, that's not important. If I were asked to explain to you what human dignity is, then my answer would be, it is a responsibility that has been given to the human being, but it is a responsibility where that which is demanded of him is within his ability and power to do. With that responsibility, he's given authority in order to do it. And his response to the responsibility and authority, that is what gives him dignity. If he's able to do that, then he has dignity. And that is exactly what the first Adam has. That is what Adam has in the first description of it. He's immediately given authority. He's given, created in the image of God. He's given a responsibility. Fill the earth, subdue it, and have dominion over everything that is upon the earth. Once he's able to do that, then he's got human dignity. So if we are to form an equation, it is the human being equals dignity, which in turn equals responsibility, which in turn is majesty. And that is the covenant of the human being. That is what he is able to do. You will notice that I haven't brought into this description of the first man anything that is really spiritual in his life. That is a separate part of the human being altogether. This is a great driving force in the human being. It makes him outward orientated. He wants to achieve. And in order to achieve, he must have assistance. And how does he have assistance? As a human being. So he must have a community. And without the community, he cannot achieve. And for this purpose, he was created, male and female, he created them. And it wasn't a question of creating a single man. Male and female, he created them. I don't want you to misunderstand this. I'm not saying that he created many men and many women at the beginning. God didn't. He created only one man. But this was the design, and this was the purpose, and this was the plan. When he created that first man, this was the plan. And this, that they would be men and women, and they would work together. Why didn't he create many men and no women at all? That is all something that we've got to do. Now, that is the first part of my talk to you this week. If there's anything you want to ask me, you can ask me now. If there's anything you don't understand, you can ask me now. Here's the fact. The human being equals dignity, which equals responsibility. And responsibility as I've described it. It's responsibility, but it is responsibility where he possesses the ability to discharge that which his responsibility demands of him. And it's a responsibility where he's given authority. He's created in the image of God and he's got the authority. That is responsibility. So the human being equals dignity, which equals responsibility in that sense. And that produces the cover, that produces the magic.
right. I knew a man once that didn't know very well. And this man was a very, very great scientist. He had a tremendous amount of dignity. But nothing about him was spiritual. He was a very, very great scientist. He was an immunologist, and Chris Barnard said on several occasions that without that man it would have been completely impossible to have done any of the things that he did. He was a Jew. Tremendous dignity. Exactly that man, who felt he had such a responsibility, and he had such authority, and he was to discharge that responsibility, and he had all the ability to discharge that responsibility, and that gave him majesty. He was married for a very short time. The marriage couldn't last. And his wife said, that man is married to his wife. He was absolutely right. Of course he had people to love him. He didn't have to. They didn't have to be his wife. And he managed extremely well. Now, the first man's need, if you take the Adam, the man that is described in the first account of the race, of course he needs companionship, he needs society. But he needs society only from the point of view of having a co-worker. But work together with him. That is all that he needs. He's never lonely. As long as he's got these people, he isn't lonely. He needs people to work together with him. Now, you will find that there is a gregariousness amongst animals. On a higher level, there is gregariousness in this human being too.
What is your opinion of that?
A gregarious is
feeling
of
me.
No. The desire to live together, to be together with human beings. A gregarious person is a person who likes to be together with human beings. Now, animals. No, not arrogant at all. Gregarious. The human being is a gregarious. The human being is a gregarious animal. That's exactly what he is. You know, have you ever met a person? He's always got to be with people. He can't be on his own. He's always got to be out. He's always got to be with people. It's a gregarious animal. Now, animals are also gregarious, and they are. The gregariousness is noted if you go into a field and you watch these animals grazing. You don't know animals well.
They are. Not. She's been here long enough.
They graze, and then suddenly there is the roar of a lion. And then they all run together. They all run together. They herd together. And they get some kind, they feel some kind of security in that. And sometimes a lion is afraid to attack when they're all together there. And he decides that discretion is quite a good part of valor, and he goes off with his tail high up, but he's off, but he looks somewhere else for his food. It can happen. But that is gregariousness. Now, man in his first role is gregarious. Right. Any other questions now? Yes? Absolutely solitary. But he was created with the idea that this is what company will mean to him. What companionship will mean to him. Companionship will mean to him only co-working. That's it. The person that I described to you, his wife was a scientist too. Otherwise he would never thought of marriage. But he didn't have to, he decided he didn't have to be married to her. I mean, he just, his work was ended. And she continued to work with him afterwards. She was in the laboratory, that's all he needed. He needed people. And he had to have people. And this is a manifestation of man. Man was created single. And the second chapter is the detailed account of him. He was created singly. And God is given one aspect, one manifestation of man. How he is going to be. And this is going to be the human race. And it's going to have these attributes, or this great attribute. This quest to create, this quest to find, for the purpose of using it and harnessing it, and improving his own living, his own quality of living. On the purely physical sense, on the purely physical level. And everything is utilitarian. But you know this type of man, it's the era in which we are living. And I shall come to that. This is the era, excuse me, the company of things. But this is the era in which we are living. Everything has got to be relevant. When I went to school, and the boy asked, we were asked what do we wish to take, what subject we wish to take, and we were sort of being persuaded to take Latin and mathematics, and one boy asked, he said, what is the use of Latin and mathematics going to be to me in life? And the teacher answered him, if you intend being a water carrier, it will mean nothing to you at all in life. Don't take it. But his question was, is it going to be relevant? Now this is an aspect of man. Highly practical. Wants everything to be relevant. But just look at the relationship he has to women. She is a co-worker with him. Certain things that she does, and there are certain things that he does. And that is the equation that we had up on the whiteboard last week, where I plus I equals 2I. I plus I equals 2I. And that is the diet. Well, I think we might come to that. Now we come to something else. And that is that, as I've said, the description of the first man, and that manifestation of the first man means that he cannot be alone in a hostile environment. He lives in this environment. He cannot be alone. And he's created, male and female, God created. Yes.
But you said but. When you said but is relationship to women, but to the woman is... He's very practical, and I think that the relationship to the wife is also very practical.
Absolutely pragmatic.
Working together relationship.
Yes. On a purely pragmatic basis. Purely pragmatic basis. You know, sometimes I don't like being too direct, and other times I think it's necessary to be even over direct. What do you think is best to do? I think so too. Yes, I think so too. I think so too. Yes, I think so too. Well, perhaps we can drive it a bit harder. Yes, you see, nature is always hostile. Nature is always hostile to man. Wherever, whatever nature you take, it is hostile to man. It's just a question of the degree of the hostile. Here, you've got benign nature. You didn't live it, you didn't do anything with it, you died. But it's benign. Now you go a couple of hundred miles to the east and come into the desert. Quite a different thing. The same nature, but look how hostile it is. So it's a question of degree. It is true that when the first man was put to where he was put into nature. But don't for one moment think that he didn't mean that he had to master that nature. To give you an example. If he wanted to travel quickly from one place to another, how would he do it? By walking. Or by using an animal. Once he uses an animal, he's subduing it. He's having dominion over it. But even if it would have been, let us assume that man would have chosen a way of life starting from where he was in the Garden of Eden and going further from there. That also means that we would have discovered all these wonderful things in the universe. We would have been able to take the atom, we would have been able to harness its power, we would have been able to use its power for other things. Which we are not even at the beginning of it yet, we don't know where it can all take us. We're just at the very beginning of all this power. And right into the heavens above, to be able to go by all this space travel that we are able to do today, that would have developed also along those lines. It would also have meant harmless to me. You follow me, do you? It would have been on a different level. And the relationship between the two accounts of Adam would have been in a different, the proportion would have been different, the mixture would have been a different one. That I'll come to in a moment. So that is the description, that is the description, the first description of Adam as he is. Now, you see, this first Adam is the Adam. The first description of Adam is the man that we recognize today. Now, when I say today, we are entering a new age. I suppose from about 1925, 1930 it was a new age that very few people were aware of it in 1925 and 1930. Only became aware of it in the 1960s. But it was already, moved 1925 and 1930. Until that time, say from the time of 1860 to the time of 1930, which was a very formative part in the development of the human race, this was an age of reason where everything could be explained about the human being, but on this basis, on the basis of the first man, everything could be explained. Purely pragmatic, completely practical. Everything is fine. In 1925-1930, something happened, but there was the barest ripple could be seen by those who could notice it. And even those who noticed it thought it was the wind, and they didn't realize that it was a spirit in there that was bringing all this about. These ripples developed, and they only came to the fore in the 1960s. But side by side with that, there was another development of man. And that was the outcome of this man which is described in the first chapter of Bereshit. This is the man who doesn't ask what is the purpose of life, what is the meaning of life. He doesn't want to know what is the universe. He doesn't want to know who is the universe. All he wants to know is how, and he wants to know it not because he wants to get to the... He's inquisitive and curious to know how it all works. He wants to know it because he wants to be able to use it. This is modern man as he has got it here. And I promised Anne that I would rather be over-direct for a moment or two in order that we should be no mistake about what it is that I'm saying. This manifestation of his man manifests itself further in a relationship between husband and wife. What is the relationship? It's a working part. The assets, the earnings, the work that is to be done, this man is what we would call the surface man. And that is that he stands on the earth and he's spreading himself out. And he's touching people all the time. He's in contact with people all the time as he spreads himself out. His relationship with his wife is, she is exactly the same as he is. And they work together. All it is, it's an I plus an I, and that gives you your two I's. Clear? Do you recognize it? Very clear. All right.
I don't see that.
Yes.
So you said that he recognizes her as being exactly like him in a way that's better. Because there's such a difference between a man and a woman. Exactly like him is what do you mean by exactly?
Do you think all women in California believe and subscribe to the view that they are not exactly like men? Do you think so?
Well, I'm not saying that.
Oh, pardon?
I wasn't thinking about it.
But I am. I'm thinking very much of this.
I can't say all of them. I think there's some that don't feel that way.
All right. Let us say 60% of them. Do you think that's what it's to say?
I think that an intelligent woman who looks at things objectively, I mean, scientifically, medically, intellectually, different intellectual capacities, wouldn't you say that significantly different?
Yes, they say it's just by a freak of nature that they have got to bear the children. But they think that this is most unfair.
No.
Radical feminists do not argue that
women are not equal.
Women and women and men are exactly alike.
They're not.
It only exists.
In what?
difference with our genetics and the difference with our learning because of the changes in society.
Yes, I'm not concerned about that the difference is
positive.
I am concerned about the relationship of man to woman. That is what I'm concerned about. Well, to what is it changing? It is changing to the idea of the two eyes. These are two distinct human beings. They work together. They are partners, but they are two distinct human beings. And they are partners. And they've got to decide what is yours, what is mine, and all this. But this is a partnership, a working partnership. And they are co-workers in this partnership.
That's different than what I'm saying.
No, this is what I've been saying, yes.
Okay. You know, I plus I equals two I is algebra. Okay? So...
No, I'm not seeing algebra.
I know, but you add an I and an I and you get two I's. You can't add an apple and an orange and get two oranges, okay? And to say an I plus an I equals two I understand the relationship that they're working together and it's two individuals, you know, one individual plus one individual, if the I stands for an individual, is equal to two individuals working together. But they're not in any way, I mean, I don't think that they're equal.
Well, let me just cover the one part of it. Let us now go to the second part.
Mm-hmm.
They're all right. Billy has got a slightly different idea, but they're all right. Yes, they've got the idea. Now, let us move on to the second description in that. And this is quite a different thing. Here, all of a sudden, we find it's not good for man to be alone. God says it's not good for man to be alone. In the first description of man, man in that particular manifestation, if he would have said anything, would have said, it's not good for man to work alone. That's what he would have said. Not to be alone. Not good for man to work alone. Now we've got altogether a different type of thing. It's not good for man to be alone. This is a man that looks at the universe and asks a question. Why is it this? Why? He wants to know why. The first man only wants to know how it is. As far as the first man is concerned, if he were to be his only manifestation, what would he be in modern terms? The first man, he would be an existence, living a life as if it had meaning, knowing that it has no meaning. He's never been able to penetrate him. You recognize him? If I were to describe another type of set as existentialist, I wonder if you would recognize him, because he's the more advanced stage of existentialism. The one that we have described is the one that lives a life as if it had meaning, and he knows it's got no meaning. Now, the next stage is he lives a life without meaning. Ever met him? I think we find them all over. I think that we are reaching the end of this stage, where you've got young people who lived it as if it's got no meaning. Now, I had a most shaking experience a few years ago when I was working and I heard somebody knocking at the door, and I went down to see who it was, and I opened the door, and there was a young man standing for me, looking to God. And he was the son of one of the wealthiest Jewish families. And when Jewish families are wealthy in Cape Town, they are really very, very wealthy. They say about the wealthy Jewish families in Cape Town that they are so wealthy that even God can't take their wealth away from them. All God can do is to take them away from their wealth. and that's a very bad thing about these places. And they say that it's a stable city. It's not a stable city. No city is stable when it's got that type of wealth. Where people behave as if they can never lose their wealth. And a thousand miles away from there, you've got another city where everybody knows that he can lose his money tomorrow. And everybody knows that he can make it tomorrow. And when a colleague of mine once came to Cape Town and he said, "I dread going to Johannesburg," I said, "What do you dread?" He said, "I've been told that he..." What is that? So thank you very much, David. I know what that is. Thank you. And he stood. And I said to him, "You know, you see, it's such an unstable place, Johannesburg." I said, "In its instability is its very stability. This is a city that has a heart of gold." Both literally and metaphorically. Literally and metaphorically. If anybody loses his wealth in Johannesburg, everybody is round that person. Everybody is round him. And everybody is helping him, and everybody is supporting him. And there's money available to help him. And his greatest competitors, who yesterday weren't speaking to him, are his best friends. And everybody wants to get him back onto his feet. Chesed. It's a town that is built on chesed. It's a remarkable place. It's because of its instability. Everybody knows it can happen to him at any moment. That is a type of economy that exists. But I was telling you about this young man. There he was, disheveled. He looked too ghastly for words, and I brought him in. And he burst out crying. The young man was about 22. And he burst out crying. And I calmed him and I said, "Tell me what it is." He said, "I was driving along the 13, about 2 o'clock in the morning." He said, "I was driving over the silver hill." He said, "I was driving home in the morning and I knew what was happening. It was about to commit suicide." He said, "I was driving home in the morning and it struck me that there's nothing. What is the sense of living? What is the purpose of it all?" He had reached to a stage where everything was absurd. Everything was absurd. Nothing had any meaning. He was already beyond the existentialist, the post-existentialist. Where the existentialist says, "You live as if there is meaning and you know that there is no meaning." And this person says, "But that's dishonest. In that case, I'm going to live as if there is no meaning." Then that's the, "What have I got to go to college for? What have I got to go to university for? What have I got to sit over my books for? What have I got to work for?" I'll do that which is pleasurable to me, and that's all that. Any case has got no meaning. And that is the breakdown. That is where it is.
it recognized it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that opens you the books of your society. That is what happens here.
Don't people feel that though sometimes? In themselves, not maybe to his degree.
Well,
you just wonder, what in the world am I...
Rosalind,
it's all such crazy.
You reach a stage where this is the way you explain it all. This was a whole philosophy. This was a whole philosophy that developed, and the people accepted the philosophy. It's a philosophy of nihilism, which started in the last century. It was already there. Nihilism, and it advocated a certain form of life, a certain form of living. Yes, please.
What can you say to the members?
You know, that is such a very difficult thing to do. I haven't made that my life. I have made my life's work giving meaning to life, preventing that from ever happening. That I have made my life's work. Once it happens, it isn't really a field in which I can excel. I know how difficult it is. If I've got to do it, I won't show. But I won't go out and look for it. Very, very difficult. The interesting thing is my son is doing something along those lines. And he is succeeding. In a very limited way. But then I'm also succeeding in a very limited way. Isn't that so?
So what you do does give meaning to this is the whole thing.
Yes,
what you do
yes, but,
is
yes,
what
but
makes
don't
life
forget,
have meaning.
Don't forget, I didn't go to that school. Start with an S.
San Francisco?
But no. Where do you come from? Saratoga. I didn't go from Saratoga and pick you up and bring you here.
Oh.
Did I?
Yeah.
You came.
Right.
That's the way we work. You came here. I didn't go and pick you up and bring you here. You came here. Well, how many people have come here? That's all. Out of a minimum of 22,000. Rochelle, you're good at these numbers. What's the number now? 25,000. I think it's a lot more than 25,000.
They don't know
about. That they know about. 25,000 they know about. And I used to say, I can work with 1% of the Jewish community. 1% of the Jewish community take me. 99% can't take me. So 25,000. So what's 1%? Could get a lot more than I've got. Doesn't work that way, you see. It's not that easy.
Where would you put 250 people?
I mean, pardon?
Where would you put 250 people?
You know, when I started, they said, where will I put 20 people? Don't you know what used to happen in the Beit HaMikdash?
Then we get in.
In the Beit HaMikdash, they used to stand so closely together, you could get a pin between them. And then on Yom Kippur was the only day on which they kneeled. How could they kneel? And then they kneeled and there was room for everybody.
When they get that crowded is when you need the shul.
There's no question. But anyway, I would rather, Billy, I would rather have 20 people to whom it really means something than 250 to whom it doesn't. Isn't that so? And as you know, I don't mind losing people if they prefer not to come. Greatest of pleasure. Doesn't really matter. And if they come, they come out of their own free will and out of their own choice. But then I know that I'm really disappointed. All right. Right.
The question is, you haven't touched 250 people in this town, one way or the other. You don't have that many coming to your shul, but between the shirim and the people who have come and visited with different shirim, and who have come to shul, not because of a function, I wouldn't be surprised if you get in closer to 50.
No. Nowhere near. Nowhere near.
Let's study.
Nowhere near. I mean, it's counting each person once.
Yeah. Well, not every one of my visitors.
Because the people come to different shiurim.
Right.
Yes, no, but 30 people come to different shiurim or rati quite a lot. But quoting a person who comes to 4 shiurim or 5 shiurim, just one person. Yeah. Very few. Anyway, that doesn't matter. It's not the, you know, it's not the number of people, it's what it conveys. Anyway, please, let us go on just for a little bit longer if you don't mind. Second part of it is considerably easier. And here you deal with a different type, different manifestation of man altogether. Where Hashem says it's not good for man to be alone. Here you've got a man that he doesn't want to know how the universe works so that he can get everything and harness it. He wants to know who he is. He wants to know what he is. He wants to know what is the universe. He wants to know why it is. That is what he is concerned about. This is a man that looks at himself and says, what is man that thou regardest him, or the son of man that thou takest account? That is the way he looks at himself. I want you to know that we are not speaking about two different people, but we are speaking about a manifestation of quite a different person. Manifestation of the same person, but a completely different manifestation of that same person. Here he doesn't think of the grandeur which emanates from him. What is he in all this universe? From where does he come? What does it all mean? He is in search of reality. He doesn't want to know what place the universe takes in his life. He wants to know what place he takes in the life of the universe. He wants to know how he can relate to reality and be part of reality. And this is a man that doesn't seek dignity, but this is a man that seeks fulfillment. And he goes deep into himself. And he seeks communion with his God and wants to communicate with his God. He is not alone, but he is lonely. He is the person that doesn't stand on the surface and goes to and fro and backwards and forwards. He is the man that stands on the spot and goes right down. He needs a partner, but he needs a partner with whom to communicate. Not with whom to go. He needs a partner with whom he has communion. He needs a partner where the I plus I equals we, not two I's. He needs a communion with someone who is interested in what he is interested in, and someone who also seeks fulfillment. And there he's able to get that thing. Quite a different sort of person. One day, I'm going to speak to you about the redemptive in the human being. That is the redemptive part of him. Sometimes he feels himself close to his maker. Sometimes he feels himself further from his maker. And somehow or other, that when he feels further from his maker, it urges him to run closer to his maker, and this time he feels even closer than he was ever before. He is not concerned with the outer world at all. Doesn't come to him, doesn't touch him. This is the man that wants to relate. This is the man that God takes to all the animals, and he gives a name to every animal. And the name is the way he relates to that animal. This is a man that's not forward. He doesn't seek recognition. He doesn't want to dominate and he doesn't want to rule. And when a partner does come to him, it comes not from his activity and his creativity, but it comes from his complete passivity in his sleep. Then is the side taken from him and built into a wife. He's not outgoing in any way. That is the second manifestation of him. It is two different roles of man, but it is one the same man. In some men, the one prevails over the other. It may be the image of God in which he is, or it may be the breath of life that has been breathed into his nostrils. One can prevail over the other. But even if one prevails over the other, the one supplements the other. The tragedy is where it is the one man without the other. It's the image of God, and it's an image of God which becomes lost, finds no meaning, it is no purpose. But it's possible for that. That can happen to them. But those are the two parts of it. And this man is creative in the highest form. And for his creativity, he must have a partner. And the greatest creativity of all is that he's able to reproduce himself. And for that he has a thought. And the Gemara asks the question, but that could also have been arranged without a partner. It could have been arranged where human beings were able to reproduce themselves. And so even if one needs co-workers, that they could all be the same sex and they could reproduce themselves. And if that were the case, what a selfish world this would have been, where a man can be completely in himself. And so every person knows that however important it is to be independent, and everyone must be independent, and everyone must be an I in his own right. Not so much for the first description of man as for the second manifestation of man. On the other hand, there must be no dependence, but there must be interdependence. That he's independent, and on the other hand, he's not self-sufficient. And there is this interdependence, and it's this interdependence that is the whole quality to life. And when the Torah says, Olof Chesed Ibono, where the Almighty laid the foundations of the universe, he laid those foundations on Chesed. That is what the foundations were. Otherwise, you will get human beings without any humanity. If it was a man that expressed only the first manifestation of himself, only that and nothing else, can you imagine the alienation, the selfishness of the creature? I wonder if we've reached that stage at any time in the last 25 years where we had people who were as selfish as all that. Didn't want to have anything to do with anybody unless they were able to use that person. That's the only reason they wanted to have anything to do with anybody. Didn't want to have any children. Didn't want anybody only to use that person. I wonder if we ever reached that stage. I'm afraid we did. Which goes to show what can become a human being. Here we have got the two characters, Mordechai and Ahasuerus. Mordechai, in Reckoning, we see him, second description. We see something of him in the first part. Something of Mordechai, which we will discuss when we come to it. But he's essentially the second manifestation of that. Ahasuerus, nothing at all. He rules over 127 provinces, but he doesn't rule over himself. Over 127 provinces. Now, Esther goes to Ahasuerus. What kind of a relationship can that be? It's a relationship of the two eyes. And when Mordechai says, go to him, she says, I can't. Anybody who goes to the king without being invited can have his head cut off. Of course. They are two eyes. She says to Mordechai, my relationship with you is a completely different one. And that is how this whole story begins. And we must realize from the outset what is the relationship of these three characters and how they relate to one another. Miriam?
You're talking about two different men. I'm wondering whether when you say men and women, it's you, male or people in
general. No, people in general. Right. Yes.
Esther's relationship with Ahasuerus was a little bit even lower than the two eyes. From what my understanding of it is, I mean, it's totally exploitive kind of a relationship. And not even wanting someone to be a partner. I mean, there's no equal, let's work together. I realize that that's not as high a level of relationship as in the second scripture, but still it's higher than his relationship with us. That's strictly, you know, exploitation. I need a wife as an ornament.
Well, he needs a wife not only as an ornament, he needs a queen. That's true. He needs a queen. And that's all it is. But he needs somebody to replace Vashti, he needs a queen.
True, her function, and her function is utilitarian.
Yes.
But it's certainly not a partner. And she can't even talk to him. It's not, you were talking about the equal thing before. She can't even talk to him without someone.
Yes, well, you follow, they each have their own functions to perform. They are ruling a country, and they each have their own functions to perform. But this is a working arrangement. This is a working arrangement.
This marriage for the sake of pragmatics.
Now, there's only one thing that I want to bring to your notice. When I spoke about, please remember the psalm, it goes, what is man that thou takest account of him, or the son of man that thou regardest him? Second description of that. And on the other hand, thou hast made him to have dominion over the work of thy hands, thou hast put all things under his feet, sheep and oxen, all of them, yea, the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, the fish of the sea, whosoever passeth the path. He said, ever parts of three parts of the sea. We've got the two descriptions there of that. Now, I spoke to you about man's being himself and fulfilling himself is related to reality. There is a midrash which used to cause me a tremendous amount of difficulty. I could never understand it until I found Rabbi Shmuel Salanter's interpretation of it. The Midrash says that Chanuch, who was a man in the first 10 generations of the human, the history of the human race, was the exception into that deterioration and that degeneration that had set in, that from Adam until Noah there was this degeneration. And this man, Chanuch, he was the one that instead of slipping backwards, forged his way forward spiritually. But he was such a misfit into the society that God had mercy on him and took him away. And said that God, and in the Torah it's God, and Chanuch walked with God as he was now. Expression it uses. There is a midrash that says that by profession or by trade, Chanuch was a shoemaker. And he was the Yachid Yehudim Lekonev. I knew what Lekonev meant. It meant to his master, to the Almighty. He was a shoemaker who was meyached yichud in the pen. I could never understand what it was. The only way I could translate it was that when he was doing his shoes, baking his shoes, he had thought of the unity of God, the yichud, the unity of God. I couldn't understand it. Why should he think of the unity of God? He could have thought of the existence of God. He could have thought of the love of God. He could have thought of the fear of God. He could have thought of the providence of God. Providence of God. By the unity of God. Until Rabbi Shmuel Salanter came on the scene and I saw his interpretation. Rabbi Shmuel Salanter said it means the yachid yachidim, the concentration. He concentrated completely, by the way, it says, every stitch, on every stitch he contemplated for his creator. He was a shoemaker. And if a human being is to fulfill himself, it means he is to relate to reality. And reality covers everything. It covers every imaginable area. And so he must relate to reality on every level in every imaginable area. How did it happen with Hanukkah, with his tunic? Every stitch that he stitched, he knew it was for a being. And that being was a creature of God. And if that being was a creature of God, then everything had to be exactly for that human being. The fit, the appearance, the durability of it. What would happen if he is at a public function and the soul comes untied? What would he feel like? That is the way he attended to his work. This is God's creature, and it's for him that I'm doing it. So he relates to reality even when he is a shoemaker, and he relates to reality at every stage. The fulfillment of the human being. These are the two aspects of the human being. Both of these aspects are to be found in every human being. In some of us, the one is stronger than the other. The tragedy is when the second manifestation of man is completely absent, and man lives as if that is all there is to him, that is his only manifestation. Thank you, ladies.